Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast about people, politics and pragmatism. So far in this series, we've touched on the grassroots populist movements which are changing the shape of politics across the world. In this show, we're going to begin to examine this phenomenon in greater depth. So, Steve, to what extent do you think these movements are a legacy of the 2008 crash?
They are a legacy of the crash in that it gave them something to rail against, I think, in a lot of instances. I think a lot of these movements were built up over time, certainly in the case of momentum in the UK, where you have basically the rejection of hard left or significantly left-wing politics by the Labour Party from Kinnock onwards meant that there were a lot of people who felt that they didn't have a political party they could vote for anymore. Blair obviously exasperated that. Those aspects led to a lot of resentment on the left, which when faced with an economic downturn such as happened in 2008, you know, it gave them something to rail against. After 2008 you have the Occupy movement all over the world, you have a significant increase in more kind of populist left-wing parties such as in Spain with Podemos. For America, where the vast bulk of the kind of grassroots revolutionaries, for lack of a better term, are actually on the right, I think it boils down to not so much the economic downturn of 2008, and it's more about the kind of the changing cultural map of America. Trump being the kind of the latest manifestation of it, and or the Trump support. The kind of the coalition that Trump has is the left. You know, traditionally, we would have referred to them as the left behind. You know, your white working class, but they're not necessarily driven by economics. If they were, they'd be Bernie Sanders supporters rather than Trump.
I reckon you've almost got three different strands, and I think we've probably alluded to two of them. So one of them, as you say, is the Syriza Podemos, that kind of left-wing insurgency that either, in the case of Momentum, is challenging a mainstream party with Podemos, and Syriza is either overtaking or has overtaken the main Social Democratic Party, who are quite left-wing. On the other hand, then, you've got people like Trump, you've got people like Marine Le Pen, you've got people like UKIP, you've got that right-wing populism, which is, to a certain extent, the working class base of a lot of these left-wing parties. We'll talk about that a bit later. But as you say, they're more motivated by culture, they're maybe more motivated by immigration as well. You've got this third movement, which is like the Pirate Party. So people like the Five Star Movement in Italy, who recently, they won the Rome mayoralty. You've also got this part of the Five Star, you've got the Pirate Party, who they're more anti-establishment, more a kind of grassroots, almost online network.
I get where you're coming from with that. I personally think I group the Pirate Party and those kind of movements in with the kind of left-wing ones. That I think they're a lot more pragmatic and a lot more realistic in what they want, but I think they're actually coming from the same place.
Maybe a more often focusing on corruption. Certainly the Five Star Movement focuses more on corruption. I think that's one of the reasons they've been quite successful in the mayoral elections in Italy, is because they've wanted to clean up corruption. I think there's this feeling in Italy of corrupt politicians who've not been answering to their citizens for quite a while. But I'll take your point. They're probably more in the Podemos Syriza style than UKIP.
I would say they're a subcategory of the Podemos kind of left-wing insurgency. Mentioning that distinction between them is important, I do feel. Because I think what you have seen amongst a number of these kind of revolutionary or kind of grassroots uprisings, which you're right, it doesn't necessarily occur on the right-wing ones. There is quite a heavy use of kind of social media. For me, I've always found quite fascinating. I mean, I work in digital marketing for a living, so I quite like seeing how people kind of utilise Twitter and Facebook and LinkedIn and those kind of things for purposes other than, here, buy my latest 2-for-1 deal. And there's a really interesting book which I read a while back. If I'm remembering the gentleman's name correctly, it's Kentaro Toyama. And the book is called Geek Heresy. Toyama is a social scientist or a sociologist of some sort. And the book is all about how technology is not the saviour. And that how if you kind of, like for education, for instance, if you give a class a load of iPads, the ones who are motivated to learn will use it for learning purposes. Everyone else will just play Bejeweled or Candy Crush.
Sounds about right.
And with a lot of these kind of grassroots uprising organisations, you can see that kind of similar thing happening. A lot of the kind of left-wing ones are kind of really heavily engaged in social media, but they're not actually using it in the right way, because they want to talk amongst themselves rather than actually bring about a significant amount of change or build a wider movement.
I think you're right. The technology has certainly helped build those relationships. I mean, Paul Mason talks how, you know, in the 60s or 70s, you would have to hide on a train into China to, you know, send solidarity with groups protesting against regimes, whereas now you send a tweet. It makes it much easier for you to be networked. But as you say, I don't think that necessarily means you achieve things.
No.
That, it's a bit like 38 degrees, isn't it? I've seen so many petitions saying, oh, well, Corbyn must be safe. I'm afraid we're back on Jeremy Corbyn again, folks, but Corbyn must be safe because this petition has been signed by 200,000 people. And it feels like just getting people to sign a petition is not an end in itself.
No. And I think that's something which a lot of these kind of grassroots movements seem to kind of fail in. And I think this goes for both the left and the right. I mean, when you look at the US, actually, when you think about it, what have the Tea Party actually achieved? What's the Freedom Caucus actually done in the Senate and the Congress? Well, they've been very effective at kind of filibustering a few things, but they've not actually done anything.
I think what the Tea Party do is they make their movement more ideologically pure. I mean, the Tea Party successes almost come in primaries. They come in primary. I mean, there's a good example in the Jeffrey Cabot Service book, which we'll talk about in a second, about Mike Castle, and I think it was Christine O'Donnell who won the primary election against him. And Mike Castle was a Republican, quite popular in his state, which I believe was Delaware. He was always willing to work with Democrats. He was going to win his safe governor seat until he lost a primary challenge to the Tea Party. And even though Christine O'Donnell patently wasn't up for task, lost quite convincingly to Chris Coons, her Democratic opponent, I think the Tea Party thought that was an end in itself. I mean, the point of the Tea Party almost is to make the Republican Party more ideologically pure. In a way, it feels like Momentum is trying to make Labour more ideologically pure, but that's at the expense of building a mass movement.
I think you're right, but then my point then is, what does that actually achieve? What does that purity deliver? At the end of the day, politics is about, you know, changing things. And if you're not actually able to do that, then you're not actually achieving anything.
I think for a lot of them, it's too early to tell. But I think on that, I think the protest movements in places like Britain and the US, we've got a first-past-the-post system. I think they're very different movements to places like Spain and Italy and Greece. We've got a more proportional system of voting MPs. So, for instance, Podemos didn't do as well as it could have done in the Spanish general elections, which were a couple of weeks ago, but they got a pretty solid 22% of the vote. That will give them a decent amount of MPs in the Spanish parliament. Same with the Five Star Movement, they've started to get some local success. Mm-hmm. Syriza have now replaced PSOC as the main left-wing party. You know, PSOC is at 4% of the vote in Greece when it was, you know, 35-45% of the vote for most of the 20th century. They've not had the chance to be in parliament and actually enact their agenda long enough for it to have any credible success yet. But I think it's easier for those protest movements to get a foothold in government. It's going to be interesting to see what happens in Italy with the Five Star Movement, with the mayors they've got. Will they be people who have just ridden this ticket of anti-establishmentism, but it turns out they're not really up to the job in the same way? And I don't think they are the same as the BNP and UKIP. You've had a lot of councillors who've been elected for BNP and UKIP as a protest vote, but those councillors are not very good and tend to get found out very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I think the one thing I would say on that is that for the first-past-the-post systems that you referred to there, in the US especially, the Republicans have controlled the Senate and the... they've controlled both houses of Congress. At least 4 years, possibly even more than that. That gives them a hell of a lot of power and a hell of a lot of opportunity to actually do things. Yes, Barack Obama can veto a load of stuff, and has done when some things have gone through. But they had an opportunity and they had an ability to do something, and they didn't actually succeed in doing very much. This is despite the fact you're leading lights in so much of the much of the Republican Party are from that kind of Freedom Caucus Tea Party wing.
But I think a lot of the fact that there's still many Republicans in Congress is down to gerrymandering and drawing up of boundaries in Congress as opposed to actual electoral support. I mean, the Republicans have won the popular vote once since about 92,
yeah.
I think.
Yes, but my point is more along the lines of that these populist movements, even when they are given an opportunity to do things, still don't necessarily take it up and actually do something with it. They're given the tool set, but they don't actively use it in the right way. UKIP is a classic example of this. They really don't like the EU. They think it's bloated. They think it's whatever they want out of it. Rather than utilise the fact that their MEP is in an effective way to try and highlight the ridiculousness of it, Nigel Farage just doesn't turn up to most of his meetings. And that's the case with a lot of UKIP-style things. So you have these kind of people who, when given opportunities to try and enact change in a PR system, which is what the European Parliament utilises, still don't actually take the challenge and actually do anything with it. And I think that kind of just boils down to, because at the end of the day, it's really easy to rail against something. It's really difficult to get something done, even if that getting something done is let's expose how bad this is. So maybe with Five Star on the continent in Italy, you are going to get they are actually going to be able to root out some of this corruption, which is pretty endemic to a lot of Italian politics. And they've actually got a core focus which requires actual action to happen. But I think for a lot of these movements on both the left and the right, what they want is in many ways unachievable.
But I think a lot of that is because they have lost the ability to compromise.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of politics, a lot of getting stuff done, is the ability to compromise with the other person, see the other person's point of view, work through a viable solution. And I think we're going to talk in a later podcast about Twitter and political discourse, but I think a lot of the fact that the internet allows you to make connections between small groups of people, I think you made the point that often people talk to each other. Well, what happens then is you end up with groupthink, you end up in a bit of an echo chamber. One of the things we've talked about from the referendum is you've got two Britons who literally can't understand the other. I think that's definitely the case with a lot of UKIP voters, that they literally cannot understand where the other side's coming from, in the way that a lot of the lefty metropolitan types that we know literally can't understand where UKIP are coming from. And there's just no common ground to even come across a compromise. Same with the Tea Party in the US. I mean, it's very difficult for President Obama to make compromise with a group of people who think he's a Muslim and or Kenyan and should not be president.
Yeah, I mean, that lack of compromise is by far the biggest hindrance, you know, these kind of uprisings are going to face. They're always born out of the desire for change and ideology. But because they're born out of that desire for an ideological change rather than just a change that works, that focus on ideological change means that when they inevitably get into power at some point, you know, they're not going to be able to get everything they want. Some of the ideas, they're just going to look at the facts and figures and go, oh, we can't do this. It's just not going to work. It was a good idea, but we'll just have to scrap this. But we can do this instead. This gives us 75% of what we want. The minute that happens, somebody within that original movement yells betrayal. Those people are then kind of forced out over time, and then the next wave comes in.
And it's interesting because, I mean, Cabaservice's book, Rule and Ruin, actually traces this in the Republican Party. His book is about the downfall of moderate republicanism. And he traces this from the 60s, how you have, first of all, you have the Goldwater conservatives who get in. They're quite conservative, they get into office, they compromise, and then they're ousted 12 years later by the Reagan group. They're then ousted by Newt Gingrich in 94, and then you have the Tea Party in the 12 years later. So he sees this kind of series of cycles happening, which pushes the Republican Party further and further away from mainstream view. It makes it even harder then for moderate voices to be heard, either for bipartisanship or those kind of moderate ideas.
You can see that exact same thing happening in the UK with the Labour Party and Momentum, where there's now this demand for ideological purity, that anybody who is not wholeheartedly behind like the Corbyn and McDonnell socialist agenda is a traitor to the cause. This has come after, you know, the best part of, what, 2 decades of Labour moderation under Brown, under Blair, under Smith. May he rest in peace. Those people being sidelined for so long, and then being out, and then kind of all of the build-up of these moderates, and moderates basically being kind of succeeding in a lot of things, but failing in a load of others, and just not doing enough on some things because, hey, that's life. You can't do everything you actually want to do. Sometimes things go wrong, and some very poor decisions were also made. Leads to a rejection of that left wing of moderation. In comes Ed Miliband. More left wing than Brown, more left wing than Blair. Comes out with some pseudo left wing nonsense and a lot of things, but doesn't really actually come up with a real agenda. But it's deemed as left, too left wing by the electorate in a lot of ways.
It's not anti-austerity enough to please the members, but it's not credible enough.
But not credible enough to win anything. So Miliband then has to stand down because he loses an election, which means the next wave of people are coming in for kind of going, well, we didn't get what we wanted during when we were successful. We didn't get what we wanted with these guys. So let's go for the next wave. And you end up with Jeremy Corbyn. And you end up with Momentum, and you end up with John McDonnell, and you end up with these people who are now, in effect, tearing the Labour Party apart because they do not see a room for anybody who does not agree 100% with them.
No, and it's that rejection of the party's history as well, the fact that actually when Labour has enacted change, it has done so from a period of moderation. It has done so, I mean, people talk about the NHS as though it was some sort of big left-wing idea, but the idea comes out of the Beveridge report. Beveridge was a liberal. You know, there were ideas in all three major parties' manifestos at the time.
Something like it.
In many ways, it was the moderate solution.
And Attlee was a Labour moderate for his time in a lot of ways.
In the 60s, it's interesting, going back to the Republicans, the slur of the moment was communist. So you had people in conservative magazines in the early 60s calling Dwight Eisenhower a communist. Now the slur is Tory, or the slur is Blairite. And you've got people who obviously have no conception of Labour's history. I've seen on Twitter in the past month, I've seen Tom Watson be called a Blairite. I've seen Gordon Brown be called a Blairite.
Which is hilarious. The two people responsible for Tony Blair stepping down from government, Gordon Brown and Tom Watson, are Blairites now.
Is, as I've said before, I think it is a real problem in a country with a first-past-the-post system. Because if you have a democracy where one of its two main parties is not functioning and is tearing itself apart, is not willing to compromise with the electorate, the political system fails. It's easier in a PR system because parties can rise and fall more organically.
Whereas in the first-past-the-post, there's just no room for someone else to kind of rise up and take that place, or it's very difficult to do so. Yeah, I mean, I think what you've basically touched on there is actually the kind of the danger of these kind of grassroots revolutionary movements in a first-past-the-post system. Most of the world doesn't operate on one. So in terms of like places where it matters the most, I suppose, are the UK and America, where they both operate first-past-the-post for various elections. And lo and behold, these are the areas where you're getting these kind of revolutionary things, and they are making an impact in a lot of different ways. They may not, they are being effective in some ways, but still failing in others. They are able to shift the debate, but not actually achieve what they want. This is especially the case with the Republican Party. We have spent the past God knows how many years talking about their talking points, whether it be gun control, whether it be the birther movement, but they still haven't achieved anything. And I think that's what we're probably going to very quickly find ourselves in the situation with the UK, is where, as of recording this, Jeremy Corbyn is still leader of the Labour Party. His leadership is looking slightly rocky, to say the least. And it looks like there will be some form of challenge from someone else in the parliamentary party. But if Corbyn holds on to power, you know, Labour's not going to be able to kind of get into a position where it can do very much, at least not very easily. They're going to be a hostage to circumstance. And even then, if we did somehow end up with Prime Minister Corbyn, Prime Minister Corbyn is going to find himself having to deal with reality. Because if Prime Minister Corbyn wins an election on the notion that I'm going to renationalise all the railways, the reality is actually doing it's incredibly complicated.
Mm. And looking forward to reopening the mines as well.
Yeah, for the railways, for instance, how do you do it? Well, okay, you can, when the franchises run out, you can bring some of them back on board, but that's partial. You can buy them out at inflated prices. That uses up all your political and economic capital. Mm. You may not even have the money to do it, given we've just voted for Brexit. Or you can publicly seize them, at which point you've just passed a writ of parliament, which is just going to kill any investment in your economy at a time where things are already uncertain.
You see that lack of detail in other areas too, don't you? I mean, one of my favourite ones is housing, and you see people on the left for years been saying, just build more houses. We're spending all this money on the housing benefit, why don't we put it to house building? You think, well, we can't just
stop paying the housing benefit.
That's not exactly that. You can't just get from A to B and just cut everything overnight. And so how you actually get somewhere practically is ignored in a lot of these instances. A lot of it is mood music, but no one actually seems to work out the details.
Yeah, and I think that's something the left in particular is quite bad at.
I think on the right you can see it in the Brexit campaign.
Yeah, I was about to say, you can see it in Brexit where the leavers just didn't have a notion of what would actually happen next.
Mm. I think you could see it in a lot of UKIP policies, but they haven't really had a lot of scrutiny just yet.
Yeah.
I think you see it on the left as well, mainly because what's happening is the decline. You talked about the decline of the third way. That kind of social democratic way is going because the third way is intellectually bankrupt now. I mean, people like Blair, people like Schroeder, the whole point was that you had that kind of neoliberal capitalism plus social expenditure. With the crash, we don't have social expenditure, which means it's not really clear where you go from there. And that's why people like Pesach have gone. It means Labour's a problem as well. I mean, it's a problem in Holland as well, where their main social democratic party, it's going under 10% of the vote now because they're either losing votes to the Greens or they're losing a lot of their kind of blue collar workers. They're voting for Geert Wilders, they're voting for anti-immigrant populist parties. And it's why a lot of the political fallout from the referendum is going to hit on Labour. We've talked at length about how Labour's core vote is not with the party. Well, can you even talk about it as a core vote now? Because Labour just doesn't really address to their concerns. In our podcast before the referendum, talk about how there maybe needed to be some sort of realignment after Brexit. Do you think there could be a realignment? And if so, what would that realignment look like? What would the dividing lines be?
I don't know if there will be a realignment in any country really that's working on a first-past-the-post system, just because the system makes it very difficult for that to happen. In terms of what the realignment would look like, I think you're probably looking at simplified pro-globalisation and anti-globalisation. An open country versus a closed one. And you can see that pretty much in the EU, in the UK with the EU referendum, where the Leave side were talking very much along the protectionist and kind of anti-immigration side of things.
Yeah, wanting our country back. There's a lot of things, you know, you can see that.
Wanting my country back, let's take control. Let's make America great again with Donald Trump. All of those things are very much of the protectionist nature. Mm. They're closing off a country to a certain extent so that you can look after your own, is the notion behind it. You can look after your own, and then once we've sorted out our own, then we can deal with everything else. Whilst the other side is pro-migration, it's pro-trade, it's pro-looking out on the world and saying, we are here and we can help you and you can help us. And I think that kind of that would be the kind of realignment I would expect to see. And I think you will start to see that over the next 5 to 10 years in various ways. Mm. It may not come in the rise of a new political party, but I do think it may very well come in terms of the reframing of some of the political parties. I think the Conservatives in the UK will end up being much more protectionist they otherwise have been recently, less all about kind of financial capital and kind of sending things overseas or whatever, and being the party of business, as we would traditionally think it, and kind of dipping in more into the kind of the UKIP well of being a bit more kind of anti-free trade, much more protectionist, and kind of focusing on the poorer areas of Britain, because one, there's an opportunity there to win the votes there, and two, those are the areas that need focusing on.
I wonder if maybe you'll see more of a realignment, a bit like Poland. You'll end up with a kind of a centre-right pro-openness party versus an even, or an opposition party that's even further right but is closed, almost like the Conservatives against UKIP. I'm quite sceptical that Labour can align itself in the way that you describe, unless there is some sort of electoral pact with the Lib Dems, which could happen.
Yeah, that is a very real possibility, that the electoral map basically shifts to being centre-right versus right, with, you know, the left wing basically getting a bit of a look in certain areas like the big cities. I'm not convinced it would happen, just because that would mean UKIP would need to actually be organised and actually sort themselves out and run themselves properly.
I suppose, as we've said, it's the populist parties don't really have that ground game.
Yeah.
And those skills of politics, and compromise.
UKIP could massively turn into the main opposition party if they were competent. The issue is, I don't think they're competent enough currently.
I agree with you that the UKIP situation shows pretty perfectly the problem with these populist movements, is they've not quite got the art of politics yet. It's about having to compromise, especially with people in your party who you agree with on, you know, 80% of things, and then you end up just falling out massively on the 20%.
Yeah.
And it'll be interesting to see how these movements mature. What happens, you know, if they get into governments, do they then to compromise effectively? Do you then get another movement that says they are betraying their roots, now we need to go on? And it's going to be very interesting to see these five-star movements in Rome and Turin as well, and see how effective they are.
Yeah.
We'll be talking a little bit more about how we can maybe shift those policy debates next week. Until then, goodbye. Slur de jure. No, I'm not going to put that. That sounds absolutely terrible.